idea. Campaigning regulations are very strict, and one is not allowed to advertise against another. These elections are held on a Friday, where in Iran it is the weekend, and jointly with the presidential elections. Afterwards, the names of the elected will be announced by the executive electoral committees, marking the beginning of a four-year term of rural and municipal council membership.
The president is the highest authority after the leader in Iran. He heads the executive power. Once every 4 years after elections, he must introduce his cabinet to the Islamic Consultative Assembly or Parliament, also referred to as Majlis. He also has deputies he selects, who then become heads of different national organizations. Those are from the Vice Presidency to the Atomic Energy Organization and Martyrs and Veterans Affairs Foundation to the Environmental Protection Organization. Every year, the president sends a budget bill for approval to Parliament by early December. MPs make changes, and after having it approved by the Guardian Council, they send the budget to the administration to communicate. That is to say, the administration dedicates and distributes revenues via the Plan and Budget Organization. And as such, administration apparatus receive their budget from the administration. About 80% of the Iranian economy is government-run. Thus, public budget plays a great role in regulating the economy. Even the Central Bank of Iran is government-run, and its chief is naturally decided by the president. By way of the constitution, the executive branch is obligated to alleviate the people's basic needs, such as reasonable accommodation, free education, health services, and food security, via relevant ministries. The president is responsible for the country's budget and planning and administrative and employment affairs. Also, it is the administration that decides on administrative and employment policies concerning 4 million civil servants. The president also chairs many supreme councils that are convened for a variety of issues, with representatives from different organizations present. For example, the Economy Council, the Supreme Cultural Revolution Council, and Supreme Cyberspace Council. One supremely important such council is the Supreme National Security Council, which is both headed by the president and has as members 4 cabinet ministers. All military and security institutions are represented on the council, and all institutions are obligated to obey council decisions. In Iran, the president has the authority to sign international agreements and deals after parliamentary approval. It is also for him to accept other countries' ambassadors' credentials, and he is of the authority to introduce Iranian ambassadors to other countries. In the instance of the leader's demise or resignation, the president will be one of the 3 members on the leadership council, until which time a new leader is appointed. However, it is the president that must sign and communicate laws passed by parliament so that they be executed, while all attempts and actions by the president and his ministers are supervised by parliament, and it is parliament that can impeach or even depose any of them.
Rome, the sacred Christian Empire, and Greece, ancient Greece, and a great Iran.
Can we really say that this system in the 5th century BC, known as the Greek democracy, was really a democracy?
You can see in Greek works that many Greek authors do not mention many important parts of history or presented a disordered version of it.
Darius tells his children, if you want to live in peace in your country, keep an eye on the Persian people. By keeping an eye on people, he meant supporting and taking care of them.
Even in the newer periods, in spite of the fact that people were supposedly involved in choosing their government, this public opinion is always inclined in favor of rich and powerful people, and it's power and wealth that defines public goods.
Dear viewers, I'm joined now by Mohan Abedin, a political analyst joining us here in the studios in Tehran. Mohan, welcome. It's good to see
you. Thank
you. So firstly, I want to get your thoughts on the, before we start on the election itself, the campaign trail. Yeah. How did you think that went?
Well, I think, judging by past elections, it was in keeping with tradition. You know, Iranian elections, particularly presidential ones, they tend to start off in a lackluster fashion. You know, not a lot of energy at the beginning, but as you approach polling day, you know, obviously there's a lot more excitement and a lot more energy. And there are reasons for that, because it takes time for the supporters and organizers of the various candidates to mobilize properly, get their so-called set out, their headquarters in order to get on the campaign trail, so to speak. So I think, broadly speaking, there was nothing exceptional or remarkable, you know, about campaigning this time around.
Did the candidates, get the policy that people wanted to hear, like an agenda? What's the agenda? Did that come across towards the
end? Well, I think for the past 12 years, the primary vehicle for these candidates to put across their policy positions and their programs is through the televised debates. That's the principal means by which they can reach the masses, you know, the whole country. And we had three televised debates this time around. I think the first one left a lot to be desired, because it became a slugging match, kind of a personality clash. But that's to be expected. Look, if you look at televised debates around the world, including the so-called major democracies, the US, the UK, that tends to happen. Look at Trump and Biden. Look at what happened there. So you don't really get substantive discussions there. But then I think the next two here were much better. And, because the candidates were really forced to really set out their policy positions. And I think it gave the Iranian public a chance to see what these people are actually about, because their personalities come out during these debates. You know, people see what they stand for, what's at the bottom of these people, so to speak. So they were really quite useful. They were certainly useful for me to understand, you know, where these people are coming from. So I think the debates, especially the last two, really energized the campaign. And look, you know, people outside the country are completely clueless as to what's going on here. They've been telling us for months now, even before the official campaign, it's going to be a low voter turnout. I personally think there's going to be a surprise today.
Okay.
Because, yeah.
Just give me, we're going to go live to the Interior Ministry, pardon me, Mr. Abedin.
Yeah.
Let's hear what the Iranian president has to say, who's speaking at the Interior Ministry.
We are taking the steps for making the electoral process an electronic one. Every year we make a step forward, and see the screen behind me, and you can see on the screen, you can see the number of voters in various provinces across the country, and also the process of identification is accomplished today electronically, and even the counting of votes is mainly done by electronic machines, and this is done in the capital of the provinces. And we hope that in the near future, the whole electoral process would become electronic. That's going to be quite helpful for transparency of the process. This is an important election. So we have the city and village councils and the midterm elections are also carried out for the parliament. We also have the election of the Assembly of Experts. But the important election across the country today is the presidential election, one of the important elections held every 4 years in the country based on the authority and the heavy responsibility shouldered by the president based on the Constitution. I wish to once again call upon the people across the country to go to the polling stations today and cast their ballots in favor of the candidates they choose. The problems in people's mind if there has been any problem since the time of registration for the candidates, if there's been any problem, that such problems must be overlooked because the election is important, and despite those problems, we should go to the polling stations and cast ballots. I wish that there were no problems since the day of registration till today, and we would have witnessed more presence by the people. But the people know that the election is of importance for the country and their own destiny, this and the Islamic Republic establishment. I think there are only a few countries in the whole world in which case the elections are of paramount importance and the whole world pays attention to the election. But in most world countries, the election is of importance for the people of those countries, but there are a few countries in the world in which case the elections are of importance for the whole world, and the world people want to learn more about people's participation and also the candidates. One of those important countries is the Islamic Republic of Iran. And in the past 42 or 43 years, it's been the same. And it's the same today. So the people must pay attention to this point that the whole, that all world people are paying attention and watching people's turnout. So we should act in such a way so that all of our friends across the world become pleased, and all Iranians and all those who are interested in this land and establishment would become pleased. And in this way, we can frustrate our enemies. I hope that the people would fulfill their religious, national, and revolutionary obligation. And people's turnout would be in such a way so that the nation would be pleased with the outcome of the election. I have two recommendations to the organizers, the governor generals, governors, district governors across the country. First, to observe the health protocols, and all must observe the health protocols. In order to protect people's health, and secondly, to protect people's votes, and there wouldn't be any mistake, even a single vote. So we should actually protect people's right, and the people would see the outcome of their voting.
You're listening there to the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani speaking at the Interior Ministry here in the capital, Iran. The Iranian President emphasized on the importance of elections across the world, saying Iran is no exception. And he said the important elections are underway across the country, as we have seen over the past few hours. The Iranian president called on people of all walks of life to show up, to frustrate the enemies of Iran, saying that joining going to the ballot boxes is a duty, and that will frustrate the enemies of Iran. And he also also emphasized on the need to observe the health protocols at polling stations across the country, as we have seen over the past few hours. Let's get back to our guest at the studio, Mr. Mohan Abedin, a political analyst. Mr. Abedin, one of the notes the president said, to frustrate the enemies of Iran, head to the polls. We've seen a lot of propaganda from mainstream media. We've discussed it at some point during the morning as well, and it's important to highlight again this propaganda we've seen in mainstream media and also regional media. We don't want to give them a plug, but they, especially the regional ones, but when you read their material, the disinformation, I'm not going to say misinformation, it's really disinformation because they got their facts and figures wrong. And then you go to their sources, and the sources are linked to a terrorist organization. What do you say to that?
Well, look, historically, elections in Iran have produced high voter turnout since 1979. They're crucial in terms of affirming the legitimacy of the system. And at no point in our post-revolutionary history have elections ever been delayed or whatever. Even during the height of the Iran-Iraq war, when there was a huge war going on, or significant internal unrest in the early years of the revolution, polls took place on time, and that was important for that. So that it's a predictable institution. People know when they're going to happen, so they turn out en masse to affirm the system and obviously take part in the administration of the country. And I don't believe this time around it will be any different. You correctly pointed out there's been a lot of propaganda, mostly concentrated on conveying the impression that the turnout this time around is going to be lower. I don't believe that. I think we're going to have a respectable voter turnout, perhaps not as high as previous elections. I mean, if you look at the last presidential poll in 2017, the turnout was 73%. Now, that's huge, comparatively. Just to give you an example, the last U.S. election, which produced a record turnout because of Trump, obviously, the Trump-Biden contest, very incendiary, that produced a turnout of only 66%, and that was a historic high for them. Similarly, if you look at elections in France, Germany, the United Kingdom, on occasion they managed to get above the 50% threshold, but more often than not, you tend to find they don't even meet that 50% threshold.
Right.
So
I mean, I think that's a very important point that you highlight, Mohan, that especially the UK, you know, which we've seen elections there over the past decade where they're struggling to even form coalitions.
Yeah.
You know, you've seen the Tories, conservative parties go with the Liberal Democrats.
Yeah.
That would have been unheard of, you know, two or three decades ago.
Well,
such was the low turnout in the UK.
I know, but I mean, the arrangements are also very different because here in Iran there's a very direct connection between the people, the leadership, the administration. You don't really see that in so-called Western liberal democracies. The UK is a prime example, perhaps, where there's a huge amount of detachment between the people and how the country is run. So that inevitably creates a lot of voter apathy. People will think, oh, why should I go and vote, where I can't really affect the outcome of the things which I care about, whether at a national level or a local level. This is not the case in Iran. I think people in general are much more linked into the system, especially the local level. You know, in our country, especially in parliamentary elections, for instance, there's a huge turnout in the provinces because people really feel whoever they elect to go into parliament is going to do their bidding, you know. So they have a huge vested interest in terms of getting out there, voting for the people they think are going to solve their problems. And the same thing with presidential elections. They tend to generate a lot of excitement. As you said, the Western mainstream media has been working nonstop to make this election less exciting than the others. You know, they've come at it through different angles, saying, you know, the Guardian Council, for instance, whittles down the candidates. Well, you know, every major country must have a filtering system. Now, in Iran, we don't have established parties, so the primary mechanism to filter is through the Guardian Council.
Right.
You can't have 700 people, for instance, standing in an election. That's impractical.
Mm.
So, you know, as I said...
But I mean, also, if I'm not mistaken, the Constitutional Council...
Yes.
They banned... not banned, they disqualified the former Parliament Speaker, whose brother sits on the Constitutional Council.
Yeah, so, right. Often the Guardian Council, the Constitutional Council, as it's now called, they're often accused of, by the Western media and people outside the country, they're often accused of acting in a partisan fashion. But if you actually look very closely at what they do, you see that they would not necessarily disqualify people, but fail to qualify. There's a distinction between disqualifying someone or someone whose qualification to run for a particular election hasn't been able to be affirmed. Now, this could change in 2 years' time, so it can be affirmed. But if you look at it, it's people from across the board. As you said, Mr. Larijani is from the so-called conservative factions. You had a former president who was disqualified.
Well, his brother sits on the...
Yeah.
On the Constitution.
So, you know, and you had a principalist president, Mr. Ahmadinejad, who... he was also disqualified. Now, he's not from the reformist camp. So to accuse them of partisanship is, I think, a little bit unfair. But look, the bigger picture here, the really big issue, is about how do you actually, produce candidates for the final runoff that are not only, national figures, but they also have the qualification for the job, because that's really important. It's a very, very important job. This time round, we've had seven candidates, and I think, by and large, they represented, the country's political spectrum. You had somebody from the reformist wing; he dropped out in the end, Mr. Mehralizadeh. You have a technocrat who's reformist ally, that's Mr. Hemmati. You had people, with a military background, Mr. Mohsen Rezai. Now, again, the clueless media outside this country lumped all the other five candidates together. But if you know something about Iranian politics, you would know their backgrounds are quite diverse, their policy positions are different, and they actually appeal to different constituencies. Now, for instance, Mr. Rezai ran on a very nationalist ticket, for instance. Mr. Zarkani, he ran on a very traditional principalist ticket. Mr. Qazizadeh Hashim, who's actually standing, he's one of the candidates today, he was trying to appeal to the youth. I mean, he said things which were very unorthodox, for instance, the abolition of military service to make the military professional. I don't necessarily think that's going to get anywhere, but that's a different point. But the fact that he's actually expounding this policy position shows that these people are coming at the election, with diverse viewpoints and with very diverse policy positions.
Mr. Abedin, on that note, the incoming administration, should we say, what do you think is the main issues that it has to tackle? What's going to be at the top of the agenda?
Well, very obviously, the biggest thing right now is the economy. Our economy is struggling for a variety of reasons. Sanctions is one reason, but I believe the bigger reason is mismanagement. And the fact that the administration, our bureaucracy, has become very sclerotic. It's become very bloated and inefficient. So the new president really has to address that. Also, there's a pandemic going on, and economies around the world have suffered, and ours is no exception. But the economy is the big thing here. Job creation for young people, that's going to be huge. And there's a growing realization, there's a growing consensus that as a country, we face a set of huge challenges in terms of finding employment for the youth. For instance, the environment is also a big issue, water scarcity, and these are all the big challenges he would have to get to grips with immediately. I think I wouldn't wish this job on anybody. I think the new president, whoever he is, has to hit the ground running. There is no grace period. There is no honeymoon period here. He has to hit the ground running.
Let me bring in Sayyid Mohammed Marandi. He's a professor of English literature and at the University of Tehran, joining us from Tehran. Dr. Marandi, welcome. How precious, in your opinion, are these elections? Perhaps more so than some might think. You have monarchies in this region, whose people but maybe dream of hearing, you know, words like elections or voter count or even a vetting process.
Well, you can also include the United States, where the election is between Biden and Trump or Trump and Clinton, and no third-party candidates are allowed to get involved in any of the presidential debates. Or even in England, where there is more openness, you had, for once, someone like Corbyn become the head of a party, and then you have a consensus among the media to hammer him left and right until he finally has to submit and exit the scene. So while Iran's elections are not completely democratic, and Iran is no utopia, but I think when one takes into account the fact that Iran is facing maximum pressure sanctions, when the region, thanks to the United States and its allies, has been in chaos and is partially destroyed from Afghanistan to Iraq to Syria, Lebanon, Gaza, Yemen, Libya, wherever you look, there's the Americans have brought about destruction. All of that has impacted us. We are surrounded by military bases. We see hundreds of Persian language media outlets owned or funded by Western regimes and the Saudis working day and night to undermine the country. Under those circumstances, the Iranians carry out regular elections, which are, there is very open debate. When you look at the three debates we had on television, the candidates said almost everything that you can hear. Even when you watch Persian language Western media outlets, a lot of what was said on Iranian TV was the same as what they say, but in a more polite way. Things that we've heard from a couple of the candidates in particular, which I won't repeat because today is election day. But I think it's very important to note that if, let's say, to always keep in mind that if one of these sanctions, let's just say the sanctioning of the central bank, if this was imposed on the German central bank, the German economy would be crushed and the country would declare a state of emergency.
Or start a third third world war, Dr. Morandi.
I don't want to go that far, but what I'm saying is that these are the circumstances under which Iran holds elections,
right,
and under which Iranian society functions.
Sure. And, Doctor, you mentioned Saudi Arabia. I mean, America's staunchest and biggest ally in the region, we can say. We can agree on that. They're spreading, according to monitoring groups, their Takfiri ideology, which is wreaking havoc across the globe, in America itself and in the UK and in the region by brainwashing young people into committing acts of terror. But why wouldn't the United States, which you know is the self-proclaimed flag bearer of democracy, not impose democracy on Saudi Arabia, for example, instead of selling it hundreds of billions of dollars in weapons to drop on Yemen?
The objective of the United States and Europe has never been democracy. Their closest allies are dictatorships. Just recently, the French president gave Sisi the highest award that the French state can give to any foreigner. Sisi is a dictator. We all know how brutal he is. Or when we look at the elections in Bolivia a couple of years ago, when they accused the victor of fraud, Western media, Western governments supported the coup. They undermined the president, and he had to flee the country. And later on, it turned out, as we all expected and as we all knew, that there was no fraud. This was just an attempt by the Americans and the Europeans to regain control over Bolivia. This is not new. This is their practice. They will support democracy as long as that democracy serves their purposes. if the democracy moves in the wrong direction as they see it, they will undermine it. They will destroy it. If a dictatorship serves their purposes, they will support it. If a dictatorship undermines them in any way or form, like Saddam Hussein, one day he's their man in Baghdad, the next day he has to be overthrown. So they have no morality. They gave Saddam Hussein chemical weapons to use extensively. I survived two chemical attacks in the war, in two separate operations in differing years, and so many didn't survive. So to even imagine that the Europeans or the Americans care about democracy, I mean, the U.S. political system is highly undemocratic. Chomsky many years ago, said that the United States has one state, it has one political party with two factions. It's a single party state.
Right.
The Democrats and the Republicans. That was then. That was far. That was before the United States removed all of its antitrust laws and the middle class collapsed, and now we have an open oligarchy in that country.
Right.
Dr. Morandi, you say you survived the two chemical attacks as a war veteran, and you said others didn't. Are you of the view that this election, this democracy that we have in Iran came at a cost, or you can say came at a sacrifice? We lost many, figures, influential figures from terrorist groups, from Mata Beheshti to Mata Kazemi to Mata Tahrani, and the late Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. All those who defended our borders, prevented extremists from entering this country. How big a role did they play for us to enjoy this today?
The murder of such people was a result of the fact that Western regimes did not want to see Iran independent. So you gave a very good example, actually. The MEK, the Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization, which are usually called Munafiqeen among Iranians, they are based in Western countries. They have offices throughout Europe. As they were fighting alongside Saddam Hussein and fighting as a part of his army in the 1980s, they were also carrying out terrorist attacks across the country. One bomb exploded literally a few hundred meters away from my home as I was getting ready to go to school. And 9 or 11 people were killed, including an Armenian family of four. No one condemned them. In fact, all these European countries welcomed them. And as we speak, they have a major base in Albania. And again, as I said, they have offices across Europe. So when Europeans speak about human rights, or when the North American regimes or Australia, when they speak about human rights or terrorism, it's like a joke, a very bitter joke, because
right.
They are the greatest human rights violators on this planet. So in any case, I think that Iran's dignity, independence, and Iran's sovereignty is a result of the Islamic Republic of Iran being a strong nation, and I think participating in the elections, no matter what criticisms we may have of the administration, of the government, of the different branches of government, is important to maintain that strength and stability.
Right. Bear with me, Doctor. Let me just turn back to Mr. Abedin. Mr. Abedin, I've spoken to some experts. They say they expect a 10% lower turnout due to the coronavirus outbreak, which is the biggest in the region, and many observers put that to U.S. sanctions. Despite the health protocols at polling stations, would you go along with that 10% margin lower turnout?
Well, we have to wait and see. I mean, I don't have the information that the government has or the expert bodies have. But look, I think the turnout's going to be healthy. I base that not on analysis or expertise. I base it on my conversations with ordinary people on the street. I think in the last, yeah, the campaign started in a lackluster fashion, but it really became quite energetic towards the end. People were following the debates. If you go to cafes, restaurants all across Tehran, all across the country, people were really energized and they were animated by these debates. So if they're following the debates, if they're arguing about it amongst themselves, within groups or within peer groups or within their families, you can be sure that they're going to go out and vote. So I think, based on just this direct observation, I believe the voter turnout is going to be healthy. We discussed voter turnouts in so-called Western liberal democracies. They're very low compared to ours. The American election last time, right, it produced a record high of only 66%. We've had elections in this country that have been produced in the high 80s. And this was at a time when, I think Dr. Marandi also mentioned this, when really the country was in deep crisis, a huge external war with Saddam Hussein's regime, internal terrorist attacks here by groups like the Munafiqeen and the others, and yet the electoral cycle in this country is predictable. It always happens on time. It's not like in other countries where something happens, they impose emergency laws or they delay elections. That has never happened here. So people trust that institution, the institution of voting, and based on that, I believe we're going to have a healthy turnout.
Right. Let me get back to Dr. Marandi. Dr. Marandi, we were speaking about the democracy in the region, or lack of democracy in the region, with the exception of Iran, and perhaps you can say to an extent Lebanon, and maybe Iraq without the U.S. If it was not for the U.S. occupation. It reminds me of the Saudi ambassador, the infamous Saudi ambassador to the UN, an interview that was conducted with him when they asked him, "You're sending so much money and arms to Syria to topple the government and bring elections to the country." And he said, "Yes, of course, we don't hide this." And they asked him, "But you don't have elections in Saudi Arabia." And he said, "Yeah, but the people like the ruling family." And the leader the other day said it's a tribal family, Arabia, before you've got a whole country that's named after a tribe, Saudi Arabia. It was called Arabia, it's now called Saudi Arabia. And they asked him, "How do you know that? Because dissidents are sent to jail. Why don't you hold a referendum at least?" And he said, "Don't worry about us. People like the ruling family." What does this tell us about the lack of democracy, about America's closest allies in the region?
Well, I would actually point out that in Iraq, the U.S. occupation is not simply a military occupation. The United States embassy is the size of a small country, and it's in the heart of Baghdad, the most expensive land in the country. And the United States is funding roughly 2,000 NGOs while it is occupying such a huge space with its embassy and while it has military bases across the country. So the United States is actually funding large numbers of people to go out and protest against its opponents, to go out and burn buildings, to attack the police, to attack the Iranian embassy every now and then. So the United States is this, you cannot call it a democracy when you have a foreign power that's occupying the country and that is constantly manipulating the politics in the country, trying to dictate terms or dictate who should become the prime minister. We know that the election of the current prime minister of Iraq was a very complicated process, and the Americans, they obviously have been preventing people from gaining office in Iraq that have more popular support. But you always have to have these compromised candidates so that the occupier will not become too unhappy. And the Americans use the sanctions as a tool against Iraq to dictate the way things go. Lebanon, of course, is a country that the United States has destroyed. They've destroyed the economy in order to punish the Lebanese people, to make them turn against Hezbollah. So the United States is constantly, any country that has the slightest amount of democracy, the United States is trying to destroy it or manipulate it. In the case of Saudi Arabia, I think it's clear to everyone. It's a very old example. The regime alongside the United States, helped create the Taliban, it helped create Al-Qaeda, it helped create ISIS. We know all these from, you know, documents that have been leaked. Right now, as we speak, they're using American weapons, a large number of British advisors, and they're also fighting alongside both Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Yemen. So when we see this combination, when Western regimes and regional regimes and extremist groups and the apartheid regime in Palestine all working together, if we still believe that Western countries are some human rights loving democracies, then I think that we really, you know, if a person is, you know, if a person wants to keep his or her eyes closed, then there's nothing we can do about it.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid we have run out of time. Let me thank our guest, Mahan Abedin, joining us right here in the studios, a political analyst, and also Sayed Mohammed Brandi, a professor of English literature at the University of Tehran, also joining us from Tehran. Mr. Dr. Mohammed, thank you for your contribution as well. So, dear viewers,
this is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, we've just listened to a live roundtable discussion with two experts, Mahan Abedin and a political analyst here in Tehran, and Dr. Mohammed Marandi, a professor at Tehran University, discussing the current presidential elections in Iran, the fact that there isn't much democracy elsewhere in Western Asia region. Many of the countries in this region are not democracies, and they were also discussing U.S. policy in the Middle East, in the West Asia region. And we also heard President Rouhani's speech as he cast his ballot in the 13th presidential election. President Rouhani said that he called on all people from all walks of life to take part in the elections. He said this is crucial for the future of the country. President Rouhani recommended to all provincial governors, those who are involved in organizing the election, to take all necessary precautions to protect people's health, to observe health protocols, to abide by social distancing and so on when voters are actually in polling stations voting. He said the whole world is now watching Iran's election. Iran is a very important country. The whole world is watching our election, and he said the higher the turnout, the more frustrated our enemies become. President Rouhani said the higher the turnout of voters, the more frustrated our enemies become. Well, that has been our special roundtable discussion with regards to the 13th presidential elections. We now go back to our regular programming. The 13th presidential election. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on Friday, 18th of June. The over four-decade history of the Islamic Republic of Iran shows that people's turnout in elections has had a direct impact on the might of the Islamic system. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, recently said in this regard, "The result of elections will affect the life of the people and country for years to come, and I hope that the 18th of June election, contrary to what the enemies want, will be a source of dignity and pride for the Islamic Republic of Iran." The leader, referring to the opposition of enemies against elections since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, said, "During the past 42 years, the enemy's agenda has been this way, that before the election, they say people will not participate. Then after the people's participation, they say that the election has been engineered, and about the elected person as president, they say that he has no authority." The leader added, "They try to suggest to the people that elections and the election of president are useless." Election is a symbol of democracy and benefits maximum capacity in society in order to advance all affairs in cultural, political, social, and economic spheres. Thus, there is no doubt in the necessity of elections and its positive effect on society as a whole. However, some persons have raised doubts which mainly have originated in other issues like their own malfeasance and mismanagement. And sometimes enemies fan the flames of discontent to question the system's entirety. Participation in elections and determination of the fate of the country, in addition to the mentioned points, is the political, social, and legal right of every individual. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said in this regard, "This is a right and an obligation. It is the right of each and every person to raise their opinion. This is their obligation too." The leader added, "Everybody should come and participate in the election. This participation will make the Islamic Republic system strong and will maintain its endurance and longevity and permanence and will cause the country to remain in the shelter of full security." The leader made it clear that election is the greatest symbol of national might, which can cause the formation and continuity of civil society and will provide necessary ground for continuation of progress, growth in the country and the Iranian nation, despite all threats and pressures from the outside. Referring to some concerns about the possibility of a low turnout, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "I believe that the rate of people's participation has nothing to do with this or that name. Rather, people look for a person who has strong managerial skills and is highly efficient for solving the country's problems. And it doesn't matter for people what title this person has or from which faction he's from. Although this issue might matter for political groups, it does not for the ordinary people, the public." The leader reiterated, "It is important that the candidates convince the people that they know the problems faced by society, by ordinary people, that they have good managerial skills, they're prudent, honest, and are able to administer the country. In this way, with God's grace, people will have a massive turnout at the ballot box." Ayatollah Khamenei focused on the main challenge facing the country, saying, "Now the urgent and main issue of the country is the economy, and the candidates should present their programs and solutions to improve the economy and remove the problems faced by ordinary people and convince them that they're able to solve the economic problems facing the nation."
fearlessness, Asadullah Badamchian, an activist and member of the Unity Council, said that on the difference of political parties in Iran and non-Islamic systems of government, Badamchian said, a God-oriented party examines who is the best candidate, the most qualified person for the office of president. Thus, a truly Islamic party is after introducing the most qualified person for every responsibility, no matter if he is not a member of the party. Badamchian made it clear that this culture has caused his party to move on in line with the values of the Islamic Revolution since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Hossein Naqashi, a member of the Unity of Nation Party, says, what is of high importance for the reformist current is trust building in society anew. Trust building should be done for the people and for candidates to introduce their programs and also their manifestos, and persons must be defended strongly. Therefore, this consensus-forming body should first base its plan and priority on trust-building among the reformist current and put its voting base among the people. This event will not happen unless the people are assured that through programs and manifestos which will be put into action, this will support the people and will create positive change for them in their lives. Persons who are brave enough to counter corruption and discrimination and stand against the groups which are opposed to change. It means persons should be elected who have the courage in their past performance and in their programs, the possibility that this change will take place over the next 4 years. Spokesman for the Guardian Council, Abu Sari Katkhodai, says in this regard, in some years we have had prominent figures, while this year we had a different political climate. Of course, we emphasize on presence of those from a spectrum of backgrounds and political backgrounds, and different political tastes have all been catered for. Campaigns are among the important phases of every election, as they help heat up the people's turnout. It is quite clear that the candidates have entered the scene of the contest with a variety of political and social inclinations and different views on various issues. Thus, they put forward their views and programs and manifestos on different problems, and people will pick the best qualified candidate after examining each and every one of their views and programs.
The limelight.
The U.S. deaths owing to the coronavirus pandemic passed 600,000 on Tuesday, 15th of June. As it did so, a former White House COVID advisor, Andy Slavitt, was under fire from the right for saying Americans could have avoided such severe losses if they had been prepared to sacrifice a little bit for one another. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Jessica Glenzer. The piece is titled, U.S. COVID deaths hit 600,000 as ex-Biden advisor says high toll was avoidable. The U.S. deaths toll in the coronavirus pandemic has passed 600,000 on Tuesday, 15th of June. As it did so, former White House COVID advisor Andy Sabat was under fire from the right for saying Americans could have avoided such severe losses if they had been prepared to sacrifice a little bit for one another. Throughout the pandemic, Republicans have been less likely to wear face masks and observe other public health measures meant to mitigate virus transmission. Former President Donald Trump eschewed social distancing guidelines to hold rallies or events. His supporters are now more likely to say they will definitely not get vaccinated than Democrats or independents. Andy Snavitt left the Biden administration this month. His remarks on CBS on Monday, 14th of June, echoed past comments about the importance of wearing face masks and social distancing to protect essential workers. "We would have had a pandemic here in the U.S. no matter what, but we can count the mistakes," he said. "We obviously had a set of technical mistakes with the testing and the personal protection equipment that we know about." He added, "We all need to look at one another and ask ourselves what do we need to do better next time, and in many respects being able to sacrifice a little bit for one another to get through this and save more lives, I think that's something we could have all done a little better on." Most counts on Tuesday put the U.S. death toll past 600,000. The widely trusted and cited count by Johns Hopkins University passed the milestone at lunchtime. Cases are down, but the U.S. still among the worst death rates per capita, eclipsed only by Peru, Brazil, Argentina, and Colombia, according to the Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. Those nations had later access to COVID-19 vaccines and have vaccinated fewer people. Andy Snavitt is promoting a book, Preventable, the inside story of how leadership failures, politics, and selfishness doomed the U.S. coronavirus response. Meanwhile, critics on the right have argued that the American people have sacrificed enough. The government messed up testing, slow-rolled vaccine approval, discouraged wearing face masks in the early days, told people to wash their groceries and close parks and beaches, said an editor of the libertarian magazine Reason on Twitter, referring to the early days of the pandemic under the Trump administration in spring of 2020. But according to Snavitt, it is you, the citizen, who did it wrong. Public health leaders, including Jennifer Nuzzo, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, defended Andy Snavitt, saying, "Criticism does not reflect what we know about who has been at greatest risk of infection." On Tuesday, 15th of June, Snavitt spoke to CNN. "We as a country could have put the lives of people higher on the list versus our own individual liberties," he said. "We as a country decided that we were going to get many, many more people exposed without pay, without healthcare insurance, and without support. And so we decided that the creature comforts, keeping the meatpacking plants open and when they were unsafe, were more important than making sure we protected each other." Although the United States has had several lockdowns, most were far less severe than in other countries, leading to increased spread of COVID-19. The issue quickly became political. Michigan, for example, saw sustained anti-lockdown sentiment and also suffered some of the worst outbreaks in the pandemic. Experts have argued that the United States still does not have enough testing to tamp down future outbreaks. Just over half of the U.S. population has received one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with vaccination rates inching upwards. But vaccination rates in Republican and Democratic-leaning states have diverged. States across the South and Western United States most likely to be led by Republicans have the lowest vaccination rates. Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, Wyoming, Louisiana, and Tennessee